The armed takeover at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in eastern Oregon ended more than a year and a half ago, but it's not something anyone can soon forget. And some people are volunteering to remember in vivid detail by watching the documentary No Man's Land about the takeover and its aftermath. The film debuted in the spring, first came to Oregon at the Klamath Film Festival a few weeks ago, and comes to Ashland tomorrow night at 7:30, the concluding event in Varsity World Film Week. This is our first chance to talk to the director of No Man's Land. David Byers is the director. He'll be in for the screening tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Varsity Theater in Ashland. He's our guest by phone now on The Exchange. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jeffrey.
So there's some history for you with the people, or at least the positions displayed at Malheur. How far back had you become aware of the Take Back the Land movement, or Sagebrush Rebellion, or whatever you want to call it?
I think, like many people, it first came across my radar screen back in 2014 when Cliven Bundy had his standoff at Bunkerville. That fascinated me. Being from Georgia, I didn't really understand the vast amount of public lands out west of the Mississippi. And that next month, Phil Lyman had his Recapture Canyon protest against federal lands, and more in general, but also more specifically, the closure of a dirt road. And I heard that the Bundys were going to be there. They were on the roadshow after their victory, or perceived victory, at Bunkerville. So I quickly hopped in the car and went down and tried to witness this thing firsthand.
And when you talk about looking into the history of the West and the public land and the uses of the public lands, I mean, this is it's quite an onion when you start peeling that, isn't it?
It really is. You know, that's kind of why I chose this little pry bar of the militia's involvement in public land and, you know, the controversy surrounding it to really explore this subject, because it is incredibly complex, going all the way back to, you know, the founding of the United States and westward expansion.
Are there things that you hear in the arguments made in the West that you would never hear in the East? I mean, things like the 1872 mining law cited as the supreme law, that sort of thing?
Yeah, you know, I had never heard of agricultural units or anything like that back East, because we simply don't have as much public land out there, and certainly not federally managed public land back East.
Animal unit months and all those sorts of things that get mentioned?
Sorry?
Animal unit months, is that those kinds of figures?
Exactly, yeah.
So it's not like you could plan to make this particular movie, because nobody knew this was going to happen. So how soon after the takeover started did you get to the refuge, and what kind of approach was forming in your mind?
You know, I think I was actually at a film festival in Hawaii working as a projectionist, and I heard about this thing going down in Oregon. Read up on it, saw who the major players were, and saw that the you know, the Bundys and their followers were creating a situation wherein the federal government would have to react in some fashion. So I needed to get down there soon, because who knew how long it was going to last. So I didn't really think too much of my approach, in all honesty. I was just basically panic traveling to try to get out there as soon as possible. I got there without a camera, without Oregon appropriate clothes for January in the high desert. And, you know, essentially borrowed a camera from the guy, from a photographer next to me in the next room at the hotel in Burns, and began filming.
Wow. So, yeah, that boy from Hawaii to Central Oregon, or Eastern Oregon, in January, that's quite a jarring change, isn't it?
It was a bit. I was not expecting it. And luckily, the people I was working with in Hawaii were very understanding about this being very, very important to me, since I had kind of had this as a back burner project for the past year and a half since Recapture Canyon.
So was there a sense then that when the next time the Bundys swung into action, you wanted to be there to catch their action?
Yes, I did. I think that after Bunkerville, that they were looking to recreate that victory somehow. They had gone to Recapture, and that had kind of fizzled. They didn't go, but there had been similar sort of fizzled standoffs at White Hope Mine, Sugar Pine Mine, that basically, you know, ended with the militia declaring victory and walking away with very little involvement from the federal government. So when they took over those federal facilities on the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, I knew that the federal government had to react in some fashion to that.
Did you had you gotten to know the Bundys in your previous visits to the places where they were active?
You know, I had met Ryan Bundy a few times. He actually gave me the copy of the pocket constitution that I carry around for argument's sake. But I had not and I had put out feelers to meet them, but I was more interested in kind of the folks around the periphery who didn't really have a horse in the race, because that to me seemed like much more of a, you know, much more indicative of a national zeitgeist and a feeling and a sentiment and more about like American identity and these people kind of casting around for what that means.
So you preferred to focus on the people who were standing there going, what just happened?
Yeah, exactly. And the people who were drawn to the Bundys as well. And I wanted to understand their motivations.
David Byers is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the director of No Man's Land, about the takeover at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in January of 2016. The film travels back to Oregon for a screening tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Varsity Theater for the conclusion of Varsity World Film Week. David will be with it. You can join us on the Exchange now, 800-838-3760 for your questions and comments about the events or the film about them, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Morgan Spurlock, who certainly got famous for Super Size Me and has some other documentary projects of his own, how did he get involved with you as producer?
It was actually really interesting, and it's kind of one of those stories that you hear about but never actually happened. as I was filming in Oregon, my producer, David Holbrook, quickly understood that this, even better than me, understood that this was something that was very compelling and was gathering the national spotlight and was also something that could point towards something larger that's happening in America. And so he said, David, you have to make a 2-minute sizzle reel. You have to come down to Park City, and we're going to go to Sundance, and we're going to get funding for your film. So I said, okay. I drove my car to Portland, the rental car that I was hemorrhaging cash on, flew back home to Southern Colorado, made a 2-minute piece, drove up to Park City, actually met Morgan Spurlock on the street, told him about the idea. David Holbrook had a previous relationship with him, told him about the idea. He loved it. And he saw the 2-minute sizzle reel, and he sent his creative executive over to our house the next morning. And then we pinned down an agreement, and then I drove back to Oregon that next day.
Were you newly equipped when you went back to Oregon?
Sorry?
Were you newly re-equipped when you went back to Oregon?
Yeah, I had gone home, and I had gotten all the appropriate clothes and wasn't borrowing boots anymore. And I actually had my car, which I was a lot more comfortable in. And also not spending, you know, $120 a day to rent. So that was nice.
Yikes. I can't imagine in the business you're in that the cash flow was all that great all the time.
No, particularly not for, you know, an independent filmmaker who is trying to make an unfunded film for a year and a half. It's largely a labor of passion of getting those stories out there.
All right, let's take a call here. We have Brian and Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to David Byers, the director of No Man's Land.
Oh, hi, David. Yeah, I can't make the film tomorrow. I apologize for that. But, hey, you're interested in it. Does your film deal at all with the political foundation behind the Bundys? That Constitution you carry a scouse, and I think it's a pretty warped view of what the Constitution means. And these guys are warmed over Posse Comitatus and John Birchstoff from 30 years ago. And at its core is an inherently seditionist and somewhat racist background. What's your feeling about these guys? I mean, Lavoie Beneckham committed suicide over his delusional beliefs about what the Constitution meant.
All right. Thanks for the input there, Brian. Appreciate that. Your thoughts on that, David?
Well, you know, the Bundys and Beneckham in particular were both, you know, harping on the Constitution, and they were referring to this Scousing Constitution that you said, you know, annotated by one of the founders of the John Birch Society. In all honesty, we tried to stay away from that in the film. It wasn't our intention to litigate that. It was more about trying to find out, you know, to me that they were just using the Constitution as kind of a backstop, as a talisman of their righteousness, rather than anything that they were actually, you know, analyzing or using any sort of for a legal foundation. And I really wanted to get at, you know, why these people were you know, acting the way they were, why they were so disenchanted with quote unquote the way America was going, and why they had such antipathy towards the federal government. So, you know, to open that can of worms was a little bit much for a film, and also might not have put too many butts in seats, in all honesty. And this is a film that I wanted people to see, to at least try to understand where these people are coming from or understand their motivations, even if they didn't necessarily agree with them.
If people are wondering about the Skousen Constitution that they're talking about, W. Cleon Skousen was a supporter of the John Birch Society. Once accused President Dwight D. Eisenhower of being a Soviet agent. And so a bit out there on the right wing. I have heard from people who have seen No Man's Land, David, that you play it straight down the middle. The film works very hard not to take sides from the perspective of people in the audience, which must be a compliment to you or what you attempted to do.
Yeah, you know, I have my own opinion on the federal lands issue, but I really wanted to, if not go down the middle of the road, I really at least wanted to recognize these people's humanity and understand their pain. Because I do believe that once we drill down through politics and ideology and get down to the kernel of values and people, that we're all very similar in that regard. And so I really didn't want to make a film that lampooned these people or ridiculed them because they are human beings. And I think that by understanding them, if you disagree with them, then understanding them is really your tool for change and to change their minds. And I think that's something that we're sorely lacking in America right now. And, you know, I just wanted to make a film that moved the needle rather than preach to the choir.
Even if you're not taking a position, I mean, the fact is you're in the middle of all of this action with angry people, crying people, fear, guns. I mean, what did it take to stay close to the events and yet still stand somewhat apart from them?
You know, I think it took me just treating them like human beings. Like I said, a lot of the media, not all of it, there was obviously examples of really great reporting out there, but some of the media out there was just kind of out there for the spectacle and like shoving microphones in people's faces, trying to get the most sensational thing out of them and then throwing that on the evening news and saying, well, there you have it. And I wasn't throwing things up on the evening news because I didn't have a deadline and I didn't have to. And I think that worked towards my advantage. And also just spending time with these people. I put in a lot of time after the cameras left. I would stay there, you know, late until the night, sit around the fire with these guys and talk to them and spend a lot of time away from the camera as well, rather than just, you know, trying to get sound bites out of them all the time. Because I really wanted to break down that, get beyond the kind of rhetoric and the posturing and get at the more human elements of these people.
So you earned the trust of the guys who were actually responsible for the takeover.
Yeah, in a way I did. I don't think that they... You know, I think they always were a bit suspicious. Mm-hmm. I think, they were paranoid of, they were trying to get out a very specific message, in their minds at least, and they didn't want anyone, you know, taking that in the wrong direction. So for the most part, they were very disciplined about what they would say on camera. But then there were certain points where I can catch more human moments, and I can see the people behind the rigid facade.
Some of those nights sitting around the fire, were people saying things like, wow, what have we gotten into here? Or, wow, hey, we're really winning this? Or something, anything?
You know, it was mostly people were excited. People, I think, felt like they were finally being listened to. They had the spotlight, and their grievances were being heard, if not understood. So I think there was generally this kind of excitement around these new roles that they were acting out.
So in the process of doing this, where you're keeping an open mind and not trying to take any sides and acknowledge the humanity of all the people, I mean, there's your own humanity involved in here too. There must have been a few things I'm thinking that surprised you, or you went back to your hotel room and went, what did I just do? Or what did I just see?
Right. You know, there were, and a lot of that came down to, the people that I got to know the best, specifically Jason Patrick. I'm not going to ruin the film for you, but when he told me his motivation for being out there, it really struck me. And I think that was kind of a little bit of a turning point for me for, you know, being able to say, oh man, like I might not agree with these guys, but Jesus, of course, Jason has, you know, antipathy towards the federal government. Of course he doesn't trust, you know, Washington. And I think that was kind of the moment where I understood, oh, this is something that is real, and his specifically motivation for being out there, while I didn't agree with his ideology per se, really just kind of touched me.
Did that change the direction of the film somewhat for you?
You know, no, I had kind of made up my mind early on that I wasn't going to lampoon the occupiers. I come from the South and I grew up in a very conservative area, and I have, you know, friends and family that I love very dearly that are conservative. So I don't you know, now I live in this rarefied documentary atmosphere, and you know, we kind of live in a situation where if we disagree with someone, we say, well, not only are you wrong, but you're also a jerk or a demon. And, you know, there's no, in this false dichotomy that I think is really unhealthy. So from the outset, I did not want to make that kind of film.
David Byers is the maker of the film No Man's Land, about the takeover at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon in January of 2016. It is coming back to Oregon for another screening at Varsity World Film Week tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Varsity Theater in Ashland. David Byers will be there for a talkback. And you can join him now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You were talking about the daily news reporters who would stick microphones on people's faces, try to get fairly inflammatory bites to put on that evening's news. This, for you, is not like making a single news story, because you have some options in focus and certainly in length of time spent on certain aspects of a series of events. So how much time and attention, David, did you devote to the capture of the leaders and the killing of Lavoie Finicum?
You know, I don't want to besmirch any of the journalists there. They were doing a great job, but they did have deadlines, and they were forced, you know, under those circumstances to very quickly distill what information they can get. I had, on the other hand, had the luxury of sitting back and letting it soak in, and then also letting additional, you know, information come out over the next year, you know, as I was editing this film. In terms of the leadership, I did spend some time with Ammon Bundy and Lavoie Finicum, both, and I focused a little bit on them. Again, I was more focused on what drew other people to this thing, because I was really trying to get at this more zeitgeisty look into what's happening in America. And so that was kind of my focus on that. And then the killing of Lavoie was obviously kind of came very abruptly, because we were everyone seemed to be kind of settling in for the long haul at that point. You know, Ammon had and Lavoie had both said that they're ready to be there for years, and for it to be, you know, an outpost for people who are similarly aligned to come out and have a mouthpiece. So I you know, obviously the death of Lavoie Finicum plays a big part in the film as well.
You talked about the zeitgeisty parts of this, where the national mood might be going, and I'm really curious about what you made of the acquittals of the Bundy brothers on the serious charges, and whether it was a sign of some larger feeling abroad in the land as you perceived it, either at the time of the acquittals or later on in the election of November of 2016.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're absolutely right there. It was kind of just a little microcosm of what's happening in America. You know, you had the federal government coming in and trying to have very specific charges that didn't really fit that well, in all honesty, in my opinion, to these to the occupiers. And then you had you know, the jurors coming out, who are, you know, largely drawn from rural areas, I believe, who are all white, and came out and said, well, you know what? And one of the jurors came out and said this afterwards. So, you know, the federal government was just arrogant. They, you know, they cross-examined, you know, Ammon Bundy for a very short amount of time. And while Ammon Bundy got a platform from his own, you know, defense attorney to speak for 8 hours, you know, I think that was kind of the mentality, is that the federal government was distant and arrogant. The long arm of the law was coming to meddle in local affairs, and that the jury responded to that with acquittals.
So when did you lock up the final edit? I'm really curious about this, and whether any subsequent events, things that happened after the main events at the refuge itself, changed what you chose to put on the screen.
Yeah, absolutely. As you know, there are still trials ongoing with the Bundys and their involvement in Bunkerville and a lot of the folks who were at the Malheur. We locked picture. We didn't lock picture. We were nearing the end of the edit when all of these folks were acquitted, and then Donald Trump was elected. And also the events at Standing Rock were going on, which was kind of a bit of a stark, a stark juxtaposition of treatment of different kinds of protesters on different lands. And so we were nearing the end of the edit, and we had made this film under the preconception, you know, okay, these guys are going to go to jail, and, you know, Hillary Clinton's going to be the next president. And all of those things got flipped on their ear. And so we kind of had to reevaluate the entire film. Luckily, we had made the film such that we didn't have to actually change that much about it. But the ending definitely took on a more victorious tone for the Bundys rather than being kind of seen as something a little more, not tragic, but a little like just kind of sad, like something that was unnecessary and something that maybe, you know, like kind of a agents of their own destruction type of feel.
I wonder how different the audience reactions were between the Tribeca Film Festival in New York, for example, in the spring, and the Klamath Film Festival in Oregon recently.
Right. You know, I wasn't at Klamath, unfortunately. Oh. But the reaction in New York was very interesting and, you know, very generally kind of accepting of it. As I get out further west and people are more familiar with land issues and whatnot, you know, I get a lot tougher questions. I get, you know, well, why did you leave this out? Why did you leave this out? Why did you leave this out? And, you know, my response is I made an 82-minute film, and I would love to make a 4-hour film, but no one would watch it, and I could never afford to do that.
So the trial of Cliven Bundy himself at Bunkerville coming up soon in Nevada. Any plans to attend that?
You know, I don't think so. it will be incorporated into the film. However, the events at the Mall here have kind of played out, and I'm trying to keep it very specific to this one timeline rather than it being an ongoing commentary about, you know, the Bundys and militia activity in general.
All right. David Byers is the director of No Man's Land, which will screen at 7:30 tomorrow night at the Varsity Theater in Ashland, the conclusion of Varsity World Film Week. He'll be there, and he's joined us here in the Exchange now. David, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Jeffrey.
All right. Take care, and pleasure to have you.